I do this for my culture, 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 culture.
And welcome back to For the Culture, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Thank you so much for checking in and riding with me. Folks, I wanted to kind of switch gears a little bit because as we're talking about all that is happening and what has been happening over these past few days in Washington, D.C., and its impact on the country, another big storyline that we have to talk about, which is the fact that social media has decided to unfriend President Donald Trump. Oh, you see my crocodile tears? Oh, yep. Some of the biggest social media platforms has decided to do their part to make sure that they kick the president off of their platforms for dangerous speech, hateful speech, and just telling straight out lies. And so tonight, we wanted to have the conversation about the impact of this. I am bringing back a gentleman who I have great respect for, and I appreciate his analysis. He serves as the professor and the chair of the Communication Studies Division at American University School of Communication. And his work focuses on the intersection of culture, law, and technology with an emphasis on subjects such as emerging media and music. We want to welcome back to the airwaves of WEAA, Professor Iram Sinwright. Good evening, Professor. Happy New Year.
Same to you, Faraji.
So, Professor, your job has gotten very exciting over these past few days.
Yeah, you know that old curse, may you live in interesting times. My whole career is in interesting times right now.
May you live in interesting times, I hear that. So, Professor, first and foremost, you work in D.C. How what was the energy like, and what has the energy been like since the Capitol insurrection, that Capitol attack?
It's been pretty creepy. Now I should be clear, I work in D.C., but I live in Silver Spring, about 2 miles from the border. So in my little neck of the woods, you know, we're not seeing people marching down the street with Confederate flags.
Right.
Thank goodness. But my whole university, which was already on alert because of COVID-19, has had to do a lot of work to try to ensure the safety of the students and the staff and the faculty. And all of the different D.C.-based institutions that I'm affiliated with are similarly scrambling to try to figure out what's the right balance between bearing witness, doing reporting, serving as advocates, serving as demonstrators, but also staying safe both from right-wing violence and from the virus.
And so it. I mean, you mentioned that you living in Silver Spring, and I'm familiar with the area. I have friends that live not too far from there. But does this situation that we saw, does it for you? I mean, how much does it really change? Because we've been listening to the media. I mean, people have been talking about CNN and all of these other. But how big of this was this really?
I think we can't underestimate the size of this, right? If any student of history, such as yourself, knows that, you know, that when nations get torn apart, it starts with these little conflagrations that gain a lot of public attention. And we already know, because the FBI has warned us, that the same right-wing extremists are planning violent encounters with authorities in every state capital and in D.C. Around inauguration of Biden and Harris. And, 10 to 15,000 National Guards people are going to be flown into D.C. over the next couple of days just to try to keep the peace. So this is I would say, high alert. This is a very real concern, and social media has been central to the process of these people organizing and creating incentives and a false narrative to rally people around.
And that's I'm glad that you brought that up, because it was social media that served as the organizing force or the organizing platform for what we saw on January the 2nd, the fact that you have, you know, conservative spaces, you have right-wing spaces, you have militia groups. I mean, all of these spaces like Parler, and then you got Newsmax, and you got a lot of these conservative spaces that have allowed people to voice their concern, their anger, their rage, and then it has become a real issue. So now we're at this point. Parler talked about they were removed. They're trying to sue Google because they were removed. Apple has removed them. Is this a shutting down, or did this impose imposition on freedom of speech? Or is this something that is necessary given the fact that that speech and that these platforms have led to the breakdown of what we saw in D.C.?
Faraji, that's the trillion-dollar question that everybody in my area of research and advocacy is asking right now. So there's really two parts of it, if you want to break it down, right?
Yeah.
The one part one is, what did they say? And part two is, where did they say it?
Mm.
Right? And each of those has First Amendment and free speech implications. Now, the what did they say, you know, if you believe, as I do, and I think a lot of reasonable people do, that what the president and other public officials like Josh Hawley and Rudy Giuliani, that what they said was incitement to violence or incitement to riot or incitement to sedition, that kind of speech is not protected by the First Amendment.
Let's stop it right there, Professor, because I think people tend to believe that all and every speech is protected by the First Amendment. We got freedom of speech.
Yeah, and that's a great thing. And, you know, I've been a member of the ACLU for 20 years. I am, you know, a massive believer in the marketplace of ideas and people disagreeing in public in order for people to come up with the best answer. But there are certain kinds of speech that have always been, for instance, if you want to look away from political subjects, things like child pornography or defamation or copyright infringement are forms of speech that we have very clear laws about, and that if people violate those laws, they can go to jail, right?
Yeah.
We all know about Jared from Subway, right, and his collection of not-so-nice content, right?
Yeah.
He did not have free speech rights to trade in those kinds of materials, right? In the same way, somebody does not have free speech rights to say, everybody grab a gun and storm the Capitol, because you are inciting people to imminent lawless action. And that's according to a Supreme Court ruling in 1969 called Brandenburg versus Ohio, if your listeners want to look it up. And this is very, very settled law, right? So that's the what did they say. So the question there comes down to, is this incitement or not? Is this protected speech or not? The other half of the coin is, does the First Amendment protect what people say in a private place as opposed to in a public place? Right?
Mm.
Because the First Amendment doesn't say anything about companies. It says Congress can't create a law limiting people's speech or limiting the power of the press. It doesn't say that the press doesn't have the power to decide what turns up on their pages or on their channels or on their airwaves, right? If you decide you never want to invite me onto your show again, you are not violating my First Amendment principles. You are making your decision about what belongs on your airtime, right?
Yeah.
So then the larger question becomes, is a Facebook or a Twitter more like your radio station, or is it more like, you know, the phone lines or the National Mall, right? So And the answer is that obviously it's a little bit of one and it's a little bit of the other. It's kind of a spectrum. It's not entirely private because the public relies on social media for vital news and information, but it is mostly private because it's owned by a private corporation. And if you don't like the rules at Facebook, you can go over to Parler. And if you don't like the rules at Parler, you can go over to Gab. Right? So it's not as though the government is preventing Donald Trump from being able to spew his incitement. There's plenty of places, including, you know, a podium in the White House in front of every news organization in the world where he's free to say whatever he wants to say.
Mm. Folks, if you just tuned in to For the Culture here on WEAA, we're talking to one of our favorite contributors, Mr. Professor Iram Sinwright of American University. He's the professor and chair of the Communication Studies Division at American University, talking to us about the impact of social media unfriending President Trump. We want to hear from you. 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Let's go to the line. Let me hear from Q. Then we got Kofi, Dave and G. Q, talk to me. What's your take on this?
Hey, brother.
Hey, brother.
I look at it like this. This has been going on for a long time. Social media was one of the number one up on the chart since we have COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the entertainment business, I'm talking about the rap artists. Soon they get on them. Social media, and they threaten somebody or threaten the president or something like that, FBI jump on it right away.
Right.
Now, this is what I have a problem with. It's all about that money, all about the dollar. People had died inside of the Capitol House. They trying to cover their butt. So they been doing this stuff been going on for a long time. Now, all of a sudden, you want to shut number 45 down?
So you're saying that it's a hypocritical move.
Right.
Gotcha.
So they trying to cover their butt.
They trying to cover themselves.
Five people, at the Capitol got murdered, got killed, and nothing on that. That's... Something else I need to tell you, Ross.
Hey, Q.
The government has been infiltrated. When I say infiltrated, I'm talking about police. I'm talking about the Senate, Republicans. I'm talking about the whole nine yards. Even the Capitol Police has been infiltrated.
Yeah.
And it's my opinion.
Yeah.
Inside job.
AQ, I appreciate you. And I want to get Professor Sinwright, I want to get your take on that because I think he makes a great point in terms of the hypocrisy. Is this a case of social media companies trying to cover their backside, saying, well, we should have pulled the plug on this guy a long time ago?
That's a great question. That leads to another big set of legal questions. Before I answer those, I want to agree with your caller and say that the double standard is ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Right? During protests over repealing Obamacare, Capitol Police were dumping protesters, peaceful protesters, out of their wheelchairs and dragging them off.
I saw those videos,
jail.
Yeah.
During the Black Lives Matter protests, when peaceful protesters were simply saying, we don't want to be killed by the police, Capitol Police made, more than 10 times as many arrests as they did on January 6th. So without question, there's a double standard going on. And that double standard points both, I think, to systemic racism and bias, but also to the fact that there are sympathizers inside of the Capitol Police Force and inside of other government agencies who aided and abetted the rioters. I think that is unquestionably true.
Mm.
And the chain of evidence that's been coming out through reporters' work has been very, very, very compelling.
Mm.
So in answer to your question about liability in terms of, who's to blame, the social media companies have known since the 2016 election cycle that they were playing a dangerous game. They enjoy a great deal of protection against legal liability because of a law that I think you and I have talked about on your show before, which is called Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act. And Section 230 basically says that an intermediary, a company like Facebook or Twitter that has, billions of users, can't be responsible for everything that every single one of their users does. Right? Because if they were, then they wouldn't be able to operate. So you have to give them a certain amount of shielding against that kind of responsibility. On the other hand, you have advertisers pouring money onto these platforms, and you have users shifting their lives onto these platforms. And if these companies don't hold themselves accountable to a certain degree, they're going to lose those advertisers and they're going to lose those users, and it's going to be bad for them. So they have to thread this needle between too little control and too much control over what people say and do on their platforms.
R&B star Carrie Hilson, who has been under some backlash because she said that the Twitter ban of President Trump was dangerous, not necessarily because of him as a personality, but because of what of the power of the media company of the social media companies. Does she have a point there? Is there some truth to that, or is she just kind of taking things out of context? Is it too much power that the social media companies will still that they have this power to wield too much, you know, to kind of shift the conversation, they kind of, you know, to stop people from expressing themselves? Is that dangerous?
Yeah, of course. Carrie Hilson is right. You know, it's a slippery slope. And if the social media company decides to ban Trump for saying some incitement to riot, it's only a hop, skip, and a jump away from them banning, say, a hip-hop star who glorifies violence in their lyrics, right, or seems to glorify violence in the eyes of the social media company. And you don't want to go down that line, because at the bottom of that slope is picking and choosing who gets to be heard and who doesn't, which is what social media was supposed to fix in the first place, was that, you know, the old media gatekeepers used to do that too much.
Yeah.
So, Carrie Hilson is she's right. She's holding down one side of this argument. There is another side of the argument, and figuring out exactly how to balance that seesaw is what everybody has been struggling to do for the last 5 years, and nobody has successfully done yet. And I think part of the answer has to be that there have to be a real, you know, part of the problem is that these social media platforms are so big that it's like an all-or-nothing proposition, right? When you have like half the world's population on Facebook, anybody who's got access to that platform has a tremendous amount of power. So I think part of what we want to do is think about how we can distribute the platforms and break up some of the big platforms so that, you know, no single one of them has the power to either amplify or completely silence any given voice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go back to the line. We want to hear from Dave. Dave, thank you for checking in. You're on the line with Dr. Iram Sinwright.
Hey, thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so just to speak on, I guess, like the deplatforming of Parler specifically, I'll preface what I'm about to say with the opinion that I think Amazon, Apple, and Google were well within their rights to like deplatform Parler via, you know, the user terms that were agreed upon previously. I think if there's like a pre-existing contract that both parties agree to, that, you know, precludes this type of material being posted on your platform, that's something they agreed to, and they violated that agreement. I see no issue with that whatsoever. I think in this instance, they were well within their rights to do so. The one thing that did sort of stand out to me, though, really between, like, Amazon, like, not hosting them on AWS anymore, and then being taken off of the Google and Apple app stores, respectively, it appears to me that there is like a small oligarchy of companies that, without any transparency or accountability, really have the power to really throttle any type of expression that they do not approve of. That's not... It seems like a monopoly on essentially being able to get like a specific viewpoint or something like that out there. I know that these companies have their own political interests. They mm-hmm. have a history of dubious activities themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know that I feel comfortable trusting, you know, a handful of executives in essentially three or four companies that, you know, whatever they discuss behind closed doors, they still have the power to essentially choke off any web traffic, yeah, just prevent any website from being hosted that expresses an opinion that,
if
it is unpopular for everyone,
yeah,
expresses an opinion they don't like.
Yeah, Dave, I got to stop you right there, but I think you're speaking to this point. Doctor and professor, what's your take on it, sir?
Yeah, this is. I think your caller is absolutely right. Part of the problem, like I was saying before, is that social media and the broader kind of web infrastructure have become so consolidated that a tiny handful of people get to make decisions that affect the fates of billions of other people. And, you know, that's never a good thing for democracy, because the whole point is that there should be a broad variety of people from a broad variety of backgrounds and perspectives collectively making decisions that collectively change the culture in small ways.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, I mean, like, I agree with Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, with his decision to deplatform Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump clearly incited seditious violence, and I think that was a violation of the terms of service of the platform. And he was right. I wish he'd kicked them off years ago. I think Donald Trump had been violating their terms for a long time. But I don't like the fact that one person got to make that decision. And you know, there's another universe, like parallel to ours, where Jack Dorsey made the opposite decision. And, you know, the world might be in much worse shape because of it, right? So anytime we delegate those kinds of important decisions to one supremely powerful individual, whether it's Jack Dorsey or Jeff Bezos, we are taking away the democratic power to make decisions for ourselves, yeah, from people at large.
And you know what? And I think that as part of this, because I think this part of the just, I don't know whether it's the algorithms or this the culture and the conditions of social media, where we as the users are made to believe that Facebook belongs to us, Twitter belongs to us, you know what I mean? So this is quote unquote ours, whereas and forgetting the fact that these are private companies, you know what I mean? Like, yes, we are participants, and some people would even say we are stakeholders, but at the end of the day, these are not, quote-unquote, we don't own these platforms.
And we don't even understand how they work, right? Like, if you log on to your Facebook account and you look at what's on your timeline, it's not just like a raw feed of whatever anybody has posted, right? Facebook, as you point out, has algorithms, and their entire business model is based on hiding stuff from you unless somebody's willing to pay them to get right up in front of your face.
That's right. So that speech,
yeah,
is not like an inalienable right. This is a right that has been granted to you because you have a computer and you have a login. But if you don't have a computer, you don't have a login, if you don't have a way to check in, that right is not there for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's this illusion of democratic participation in the process. And the,
yeah,
reality is that the number of stakeholders and decision makers is probably even smaller than it was back in the days when the First Amendment was written and you had to own a printing press to get the word out.
Wow. Let me go get one more call in. I want to get G very quickly. G, thank you for checking in. What's your take on this?
Gentlemen, how you doing today?
I'm good, G. How are you, man?
Professor, you were right on point. Free speech is supposed to not be able to incite people to riot and do what you're supposed to do. The reason is that this platform kept going on like this because this person at the office, this president, Ed, thought that he has the right to say whatever he wanted to say without a backlash. You have people in office who kept backing him up on this situation. And now the situation has gone out of hand. Now everybody wants to apologize. Everybody goes, you know what, you're still not going to be able to get those people out. One more thing. This old Roman... member of Congress of the Senate said these words. His name was Cicero. He says, "I'm not worried about the enemy outside my gate. I'm worried about the enemies that's inside, opening the door to let them in." And this is what caused this problem. Now you got people coming out of the network wanting to do harm and hurt the people. And Brazzi, what she talked about before about, you know, what going on with the white supremacists and all this stuff. This is never going to change. I'm not looking for an apology from them. Just need to move forward, because why? They're going to get left behind in some way, shape, form, fashion, and we're going to keep moving forward.
Hey, so G, I appreciate you.
And y'all have a blessed day.
You too, brother, and you're making a great point. Professor, what's your take on that? And I guess the bigger question is, You know, how do we handle this moment? Should there be an institutional government mandated guidelines that's put in place, you know, as a result of this, or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. On the one hand, you don't like the market has basically failed us, right? You know, you have Facebook and Twitter, Google, let's not forget YouTube, which still hasn't deplatformed Trump, knowing full well that disinformation and incitement are happening on their platforms and either acting not at all or too late. On the other hand, every time you get the government involved in trying to regulate speech, they make more of a mess of it than it was before they got started. So I think what we really need, if I were Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, I would come in and I would appoint like a blue ribbon commission to come up with a set of proposed self-regulatory guidelines for tech and social media and platform companies with some kind of regulatory basis to enforce people's participation and threaten further legislation and further regulation if the industry doesn't do a better job at self-regulating. But ultimately, the problem is that people paint it in this like black and white terms, like, you know, all or nothing. Like, should Facebook, you know, edit what people say, or should it leave it alone? And the reality is that there's a real spectrum, and it comes down to like weird decisions, like, you know, Facebook's decision to let you like not just like something but give it a smiley face or a sad face.
Mm-hmm.
Like that little decision that just seems like an everyday thing, like, oh, now I can like tell my kid how much I love the pictures of my grandchildren. That decision incentivizes users to engage emotionally on a different level than they did before.
Right.
Right. So we have to, what we really have to do is look at the actual, what technology people call affordances, the bells and whistles and the levers and the gears that actually fuel these social media platforms, and figure out, like, if you change this aspect of the platform, what is the social effect going to be? Is that going to rile people up, or is that going to make people be smarter and have them make better decisions?
Ah.
And I think those are the kinds of questions that researchers in my field and other fields are busy trying to answer, and tech needs to listen to them, and Washington needs to listen to them.
Professor Ironson, right? That's why we have you on the show, so we can listen to you, so we can know the secrets of the algorithms and what's going on behind those closed and virtual doors. Professor Ironson, right, who serves as the chair of the Communication Studies Division at American University. Professor, you know what? We're going to have you back on, sir. There's no doubt about that. 2021 is going to be our year that you're going to have to break it down for us.
You bet. Thanks so much, Faraj.
I appreciate you. Thank you. Folks, we got to take a final pause. When we come back, let's talk about what the state is doing to address the issue of child trafficking. Stay rotten with me. It's For the Culture on WEAA.
I do this for my culture.
Peace and welcome back to For the Culture here on WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm your host, Faraji Muhammad. Man, oh man, we've been having some powerful conversations. Again, we want to thank Professor Iram Sinwright for that discussion. Folks, as part of the final conversation for tonight, I thought it would be appropriate for us to have a discussion about the issue of child trafficking. Now, why am I bringing this up? Well, did you know that January is Human Trafficking Month? And so this is something that we want to bring.
Turn off the music.
Human Trafficking Awareness, excuse me. And this is something that we want to bring to your attention, because there are efforts across the state and around the country around this issue. Now, I know we've been dealing with COVID and so many other things, and now we got what's happening in D.C., but this is really a problem. Is it a pandemic? Is it an epidemic? I don't want to go back and forth on semantics, but the fact is, it's a problem. And so the Governor's Office of Crime Control and Prevention, the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and the Maryland Department of Human Services, and the Maryland Human Trafficking Task Force all came together to host the Maryland Child Trafficking Virtual Conference. Their first day of the conference started today. They will end the conference tomorrow. But this is just one part of different efforts to address this issue. Here to join us for the conversation tonight, we will have two guests. The first guest is Mr. Glenn Fuston, who serves as the executive director of the Maryland Governor's Office of Crime Prevention, Youth and Victim Services. And then we're also joined by Heather Amador, who is the program and policy administrator of Victim Services. And she's to talk to us a little bit about, you know, what policies will be in place. So we want to welcome Glenn and Heather to the show. Good evening, Glenn. Good evening, Heather. How are you?
Good evening. Thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely.
Doing great.
Good, good. Glenn, you can hear us loud and clear?
I certainly can. I just got to figure out how to turn the mute button off.
Oh, okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. First, let's talk a little bit about this virtual conference around this issue, and more importantly, this issue, because when people think of child trafficking, it's not the most it can be a very unsettling discussion to have, Glenn. Talk to us a little bit about where we are in this in dealing with this issue. Can we call it a pandemic? Is it an epidemic? What's the best way to look at it?
Well, I certainly don't want to put labels on there. I think you did a great job of saying that. Let's get out of the semantics. But it's certainly an issue in the state of Maryland, in the country, and in the world in general. You know, we're really excited that we were able to have this conference today. We partnered with the United States Attorney's Office, with the Maryland Department of Human Services, as well as the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And it really brings awareness to the issue of child trafficking to the general public, because, you know, I don't think people realize that it's such a problem here in this area. They have maybe a misperception that human trafficking or child trafficking is this issue that there's a few people that are trafficked overseas into the United States, and that does happen, but it's really a problem right here in our backyards where young women and young men are from the United States are being trafficked for sexual purposes, labor purposes, and the like. And it's just a horrible thing.
Now, from my understanding, Glenn, Maryland is in a very unique space because we're like right there on the coastline. We're in between some of the Baltimore's particularly, but the state is right there between, you know, you got New York, you got Philly, and then you cross over when we get into the southern portion of the country. But how give us a context. How much activity happens within the state?
You know, so there's always really hard to say how much human trafficking or child human trafficking there is in the state, because it goes so under-reported is a challenge for us. So, you know, we certainly have that challenge, and it's something that we're trying to address. We're bringing training to people in Maryland. We've trained over 1,000 people to help identify the signs of human trafficking. Mm-hmm. But just generally, in some statistics to give you, you know, the Polaris Project, which is a national network that does a really good job of addressing human trafficking concerns, they identified that in 2019 there was 402 victims identified, and that there were 45 businesses that related. And I can further tell you the governor funds a program called the Maryland Criminal Intelligence Network, and they to date have identified 200 human trafficking organizations just here in the state of Maryland.
Wow.
Yeah. So luckily they were also able to, because of the governor's approach, takes a multidisciplinary approach, we identified 126 victims and were able to get them some help.
That's fantastic. But 200 human trafficking organizations in the state?
Yeah. You know, and these organizations, they're made up of three or more individuals that are working together, have an organized structure, a leadership role to traffic individuals. It's much more prevalent than people believe it is.
Now, is there a particular area of the state that it has more those organizations?
You know, I mean, I think it's all over the state is the challenge. I think that they tend to congregate we were talking earlier about Maryland being a unique place, and it certainly is. I mean, we have, unfortunately, all the ingredients that human traffickers like. We have a lot of money. There's a lot of people here in the state of Maryland. There's a lot of large events in the state of Maryland. And there's a lot of transportation modes into the state of Maryland. So if you look at that I-95 corridor, you look at 270, you look at, 81, 83, it's all right there and right for the trafficking, just as you pointed out.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that as well. And Glenn, and we're going to bring Heather in this conversation in a moment, but I'm wondering, because of COVID-19 and the restrictions of travel, how does COVID-19 impact this?
I think Heather will be able to, she's a real expert, by the way, just so you know, but she'll be able to talk about some of the impacts that it's having on the victims themselves and the inaccessibility sometimes to get services and the like. But, I mean, COVID certainly has an impact, obviously, with the travel restrictions and the like. But, unfortunately, as we know, these criminals and these criminal networks, they have their way to continue doing their business, even in the times of COVID. But I think one of the things that, Heather and I were talking about earlier today was just simply being able to have resources for these children to call in, to the human trafficking hotline that's run by Polaris. But having caring adults that are witnessing them, they're not in schools, they're not in their different clubs and communities, so it might be harder for them to identify it.
Absolutely. Heather, I want to bring you into this conversation because, I think, Glenn, made some valiant, some very valuable points about the fact that this is a situation that's much bigger than a lot of people have imagined. But I still feel like people... It's not on the radar for a lot of people. How do we have a conversation about such a big issue that's off the radar to make it important about for other people to understand and to get involved with?
I really think the key to that is making sure that we are engaging the community with the fact that this is, in fact, occurring within our community. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of times rape shield laws where victims of any type of sex-based offense are prevented from essentially being those incidents being publicized in any way. So I think the media often overlooks those because it's not really newsworthy when you have no components that make up the good story. You're not publishing the name. You're not giving the location. So I think people kind of live in this sense that those things aren't existing because they're not really being reported on, when in fact they are reported, when in fact they are occurring very regularly. To answer your question a few moments ago about how COVID has impacted victim services as it pertains to this, one of the biggest hurdles for victims of human trafficking is housing insecurity. Obviously, with COVID and the restrictions on occupancy at shelters and safe houses being significantly diminished, we've relied heavily on hotels and things like that to help support victims once they are recovered from trafficking. It is child victims that really fall into an unusual gap because they are unable to be placed into hotels because of the age restrictions. You can't obviously put a child in a hotel alone. And it sounds as though social services is also having difficulty placing children, period, at this time in some areas because foster homes are less likely to take children who either have not quarantined or have potentially been exposed or maybe have even tested positive for COVID. So it does create some really unique situations for making sure that victims are being provided with services, and especially housing, which is one of the biggest barriers.
Heather, talk to us a little bit about, what were some of the things that was discussed on this first day of this virtual conference, and have there been, you can give us an update about any policies to address this issue.
On the first day of this conference, we did some very basic overviews. We had some really positive engagement from members of the community and the victim services community. They were able to, in some ways, even network or ask questions or essentially get out there the issues that they are facing. And obviously, one of the biggest things, even though we're all addressing the same topic of human trafficking, it really varies regionally. You're going to have a very different pool of resources for a victim that is trafficked in Baltimore versus a victim that is trafficked in Somerset County. And that's from housing to financial resources to access to counseling, access to Wi-Fi. I mean, obviously right now Everyone is remote, and there are some parts of the state that do not even have access to Wi-Fi or regular ability to stream data or to participate in telehealth for counseling or services with any type of service provider from legal services on up. So it really is an opportunity to for even those of us in the policy field to see what problems exist out there and try to figure out ways to address them.
And what policies are already on the books versus the policies that are still being talked about that will address this?
So I think one of the biggest ones is we do currently have resources available to child trafficking victims through the Child Sex Trafficking Screening and Services Act of 2019 that Governor Hogan signed into law. And this is essentially something that my office feels very passionate about. It is establishing a regional navigators program to ensure that child victims of sex trafficking are referred to correct services. It is eventually going to be a program that is statewide. We currently have it expanded into 10 jurisdictions. Those jurisdictions are Anne Arundel County, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Cecil County, Frederick County, Harford County, Howard County, Montgomery, Prince George's, and Washington counties. Our hope is that sometime in the very near future, within the next year or not long after, that we will expand those services statewide and be able to provide more on in those other jurisdictions to ensure that victims are getting a continuity of services across the state. From where they are discovered being trafficked might not be where they are actually going to live and receive services. So we need to make sure that we are addressing that at the policy side.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead, Glenn. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, just if I could just add to what Heather was talking about. I mean, Governor Hogan has really made a real strong push to bring the issue of human trafficking to the forefront for the state of Maryland. And we can roll back even further. I mean, he created, for the first time, the Victim Services Unit in the state of Maryland, which brings all of our victim resources from the state perspective all under one house. And that's under our office, and Heather's a lead component to that. But, I mean, some interesting information that we might not all be aware of, you know, Governor Hogan signed into law in 2019 classifying felony human trafficking as a violent crime. If you can believe, up until then, it wasn't considered a violent crime.
Wow.
Nor was labor trafficking a felony. I mean, that's the kind of insight and kind of information that we need to share to get out to people so that they know. I mean, it's certainly a violent crime.
And what impact does that make with, you know, making that designation from, you know, not being considered a violent crime to violent crime? Does that now mean that is there more jail time? What does that mean?
Certainly, it means that there's more jail time involved, but the punishment is stiffer for that individual. You know, and I certainly don't want to give the impression that we're looking to incarcerate everybody. The governor in 2016. Signed into law also the Justice Reinvestment Act. And in the Justice Reinvestment Act, what it's looking at is it's looking at violent offenders. And if you're a violent offender for those violent crimes that are classified in the state of Maryland, which now we're lucky that felony human trafficking is classified as that, you should go to jail and you should be protected. You should be protected from the community. We're going to get you resources and we're going to help you reintegrate in the life once you're incarcerated. But the other crimes that are not violent, work with you outside of the prison system in order to, divert and deflect you from the criminal justice system as a whole. And we found that that's much more sustainable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Folks, if you've been tuned in to For the Culture here on WEAA, I've been talking to Heather Amador of Victim Services. Heather has been doing the work of making sure that victims of human trafficking is supported. She serves as the program and policy administrator of Victim Services for the state. And we also been talking to Mr. Glenn Fuston, who serves as the executive director of the Maryland Governor's Office of Crime Prevention, Youth, and Victim Services. I'm wondering, you know, are we at a place right now, Heather, given the culture that we live in, is the culture that we live in, does that add to more cases of human trafficking? Since you're talking about, sex trafficking, you're talking about using children and underage adults for labor. I mean, it seems like, the cultural signs is one thing. When I go on social media and I see certain things and I'm like, this is a little flighty. This is like it's on the edge of something. But then it's acceptable. But then when you start to hear how the law describes human trafficking, child trafficking, sex trafficking, it falls into that category. Am I crazy in thinking that?
No, not at all. And I will say, I think a big part of that is, especially now when we are operating under a time where everyone is online,
right,
we are actually encouraging children to participate more in online activities than we are to go outside and play. You know, we're almost at times, because of that, putting them in a situation of being groomed or having more access. Predators or people who are looking to traffic children having more access to groom them, or you know, encouraging communication in online sources and online resources.
Yeah.
You know, and as Glenn touched on briefly before, you know, our children now are even missing out on some of those opportunities for, you know, having an exit. If they're being exploited or trafficked from within a home, they are not having that face-to-face with the teachers where they are potentially being recognized for injuries or a change in behavior or a change in mental health status. You know, the teachers now are virtual as well. So those really big mandated reporting incidents that teachers were picking up on and reporting, you know, situations with children to Department of Social Services, those are missing now because of the COVID situation and the virtual learning situation. I will also say that it is sometimes very difficult for victims to break away from a trafficker if the resources that can be provided do not meet all of their financial needs.
Yeah.
It is very difficult for someone to say, sure, I will enter a homeless shelter because this is better than my current situation. But if you couple that with addiction and they know that they're going to be, you know, faced with withdrawal and other factors that feed into victims not escaping trafficking, you know, we do have to find a way of stepping up and making sure that we are providing full services to all victims who are being trafficked and addressing their individual needs as it pertains to their trafficking, whether they are being financially controlled by housing, controlled by substance abuse, those things, controlled by love, I mean, controlled by companionship.
Yeah.
There are plenty of people who, you know, are trauma bonded and really need all of those services at one stop in order to be able to escape the situation that they are in.
Heather, as we close out this conversation, I want to get your thoughts on this. You know, what's one recommendation you would offer to the community on, you know, either becoming much more informed about this issue or to get engaged and active into this issue? What can the community do from this vantage point?
You know, if you know someone that's being trafficked, encourage them to get help. There was a very big case recently that came out of one of the jurisdictions, one of the metropolitan areas in the state of Maryland, where 13 victims were identified in a single incident, and only one victim actually accepted the services. The rest chose not to accept services. And I think that speaks really significantly to the impact that being trafficked has on a victim. It is not as simple as walking away. It is not as simple as feeling rescued. It is not as simple as feeling safe. There are other components that go into that. So if you know someone that's being trafficked, if you see a situation where you think someone is being trafficked, by all means report it. Follow up with reporting, follow up with providing services, follow up with anything you can that you think will help that person, because they might not accept the services the first time, but maybe it'll take the third or fourth or fifth.
Wow.
Just be consistent. And definitely, like everything else that appears to be criminal in nature, if you see something, say something, and do your best to try to help identify victims and get them in touch with either service providers or law enforcement.
Glenn, I want to get your response to that, but also ask the question, Glenn. I mean, there is a sex offenders registry. Is there a database of human traffickers that's available that people can tap into or at least be informed of?
A couple things. In terms of what can we do in order to stay aware and out there, I agree 100% with Heather. I think keeping ourselves informed is the most important thing. We need to make sure that those folks that are in touch with children, young adults, those that could be victimized by human trafficking are aware of it, and that we provide support to those individuals. sometimes the stigma that is associated with human trafficking is one of the biggest detriments to human trafficking victims. So we need to make sure that we educate ourselves and get people hope in order to get out of those situations. The Polaris Project, which is a national project, is the national hotline for reporting human trafficking. I certainly would get that information out. That's 888-373-7888. So I certainly would encourage people to report that, as Heather mentioned. In terms of the database for human traffickers, no, there's not a database that I'm aware of with that type of information. But there's certainly, if there's involved in the sexual abuse, and we have them in that database.
Absolutely.
Human trafficking, no.
You know what? I appreciate the both of your efforts, and you know, I'm glad that we were able to have this conversation, and we look forward. I know that the last day of the conference is tomorrow, but I would love to bring you both back on to talk about what the next steps are, even after this conference, because again, as I mentioned, this conference is just a small part of it. But there are many things that your offices will be working on to address this issue. So I would certainly love to bring you both back on.
Well, we certainly would appreciate that. And now you are part of the solution. You're helping us get that message out. And we really appreciate you helping us do that. You know, I think that's part of the biggest the solution that we could do.
Absolutely. Glenn Fuston, who serves as the executive director of the Maryland Governor's Office of Crime Prevention, Youth and Victim Services, and Heather Amador, who serves as the program and policy administrator of Victim Services. Thank you so much for being on here to bring awareness to Human Trafficking Awareness Month. Thank you so much for your work, and we look forward to bringing you back on.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Absolutely. And folks, if you have some questions or if you have some, you know, if you feel like, as Heather said, someone is being trafficked or you just might be suspicious of some things, you want to definitely give the call to the Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-888-373-7888. All right, folks, that is going to do it for us. I thank each and every one of you for being a part of the conversations. I want to thank my fantastic guests. Of course, all this week, we're going to continue to bring you up to date on all that's happening in Washington. We're expected to get some more voices. Tomorrow, we're going to be checking in with one of our very own, Dean Dwayne Wickham, to give us some insight about what we're seeing in Washington, D.C. He can give us some history, some context, and certainly some analysis about what's next for both the Republican and the Democratic Party, but most importantly, for the Black community. So we'll have that big conversation tomorrow with Dean Wickham. All right, stay tuned. Up next is Lola with In the Groove. Make sure you do your part to check us out at WEAA.org to get all of the latest news and information from Washington to wherever you are. You can also check out all of our big conversations, big interviews that we've had, and so much more. Make sure that you check out WEAA.org and download that app to your smartphone or your device to make sure you take WEAA along with you everywhere you are, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's at WEAA in your app store, WEAA.org. As always, folks, I want to thank my fantastic team, Mallory Pinker-Pierre. I want to thank my man Sean Don for making me sound so good. And, of course, my wonderful producer, Demi Goff. Stay tuned. Up next is Lola Within the Groove. Never be afraid to challenge what's wrong. Stand for what's right while being yourself in the process. I look forward to talking to you tomorrow for another exciting conversation right here on For the Culture, here on WEAA 88.9 FM and WEAA.org. Absolutely the voice of the community. And remember, Baltimore, do more, but be exceptionally good for the culture. Peace.